Edward the Confessor had chosen as his heir. He wants to stress the legitimacy of his rule. So doing things the way they'd always been done in the past, that's a good way to smooth over the rupture caused by the conquest. Let's forget all about the fact that I actually had to come in and take England by arms. So William doesn't make any big changes at first. Writs continue to come out of the Royal Writing Office. They're still written in Old English, which means the same clerks are still at work. The Normans certainly didn't bring anybody with them who knew English, so the same people are doing the same jobs. The courts at all their various levels, shire court, hundred court, they're meeting as usual. And in fact, William felt so secure that the English administration was going to be going on as normal that he felt perfectly safe going back to Normandy a few months after he was crowned King of England. Normandy was always a bigger worry than England was. There tended to be more trouble from the nobles in Normandy than there was from the nobles in England. So William felt he was needed on the Norman side of the Channel. And in fact, this was going to be the pattern for the next century and a half. During all this period that English kings also had a lot of land in France, they often have to spend more than half of their time in France, because it's a lot easier to leave England to its own devices than to leave the French lands to their own devices. The French lands are going to cause you much more trouble. But William does take some sensible precautions before he leaves for Normandy. He takes English hostages with him to Normandy. These are prominent English figures he wants to keep an eye on. People like Archbishop Stigand, like the Earls, Edwin and Morcar, and naturally enough, Edgar Atheling. William doesn't want them in England, where they could possibly serve as rallying points for rebellion. So they go with him to Normandy. They're not really prisoners. They're just guests who can't exactly leave when they want to. But of course, later on, they do. But the honeymoon period doesn't last, and William has to spend the next 5 years fighting off various rebellions in England, starting from late in 1067, only a year into William's reign. In the western part of England, a shadowy figure named Edric the Wild is on the loose in the border areas between England and Wales. He attracts some significant support. And there's also an uprising in Exeter in the southwest. But the most serious uprising happens in the north of England. And this is always where the biggest problems happen. It turns out that William had been right to bring those hostages with him to Normandy. As I said, they don't stay. He lets most of them go shortly after they arrive in Normandy. That was probably a mistake. In 1068, the Earls Edwin and Morcar, they join up with another Northern English leader, a guy named Gospatric. And these three English leaders send feelers out to the Danish king, Swain Estrithson. Swain is related to King Knut, so he has something of a claim to the English throne himself. And the English nobles want Swain to come to England and help them get rid of William. At the same time, the earls also begin to push the claims of Edgar Atheling. Edgar Atheling had gone to Scotland when he was tired of hanging out with William the Conqueror in Normandy. But William found out about this little project. As I've said, it's hard to keep a secret in the 11th century. And William responded vigorously by campaigning throughout England, especially by making a bold northward thrust up to York and then down south to Cambridgeshire. And all along the way, he's building castles and he's demanding the submission of English leaders. Wherever he goes, he does this. And this is a very effective method. He's showing the flag. He's saying, I'm going to show up and I'm going to make sure that you do what I want. And it works, at least temporarily. The rebels in the north are intimidated for the moment. Okay? But early in 1069, an incident in the far north, in Durham, sets off a major revolt. A Norman official is sent up to Durham to take control there. And somehow he gets involved in a piece of local unpleasantness. I've said before, things in the north can be a bit different. It's a very old feud, and he ends up in the middle of it, and he's set upon in a house and burned to death. And this is the trigger for a widespread revolt, and it quickly spreads south to York. Now, Edgar Atheling is getting ready to move south from Scotland, but he's not fast enough for William. The king moves north again at a breathtaking pace, and he retakes the city of York. The situation gets more serious, though, a bit later in the year, because the Danish king, Svein Estridsson, finally acts on the earlier call for help that the English nobles had sent him. Just like the Danish kings in the early 11th century, Svein is hoping to capitalize on any pro-Danish feelings that might still be out there in the north and east of England. So he sends one of his sons to England with a fleet. This fleet anchors in the Humber River. Edgar Atheling and other northern magnates join in the revolt. York is retaken from the Normans. York is changing hands in this period at a dizzying pace. The local peasants around York welcome the Danish soldiers, as expected. They seem to have looked on them as liberators. There are repercussions in Scotland as well. I mentioned Edgar Atheling being in Scotland. Well, now that things are looking more positive for Edgar, the Scottish king, Malcolm, decides maybe it would be a good idea to marry Edgar's sister, Margaret. I think King Malcolm is hoping that he's marrying the sister of the future King of England. Now, it didn't work out that way, but ultimately this marriage is going to be very important in English history. We'll see that in the next lecture, because it would produce a very important Queen of England. But let's go back to the revolt in 1069. It looks bad for King William. He has a Danish force on English soil. His rival for the English throne, Edgar, is now related by marriage to the Scottish king. But William is up to the challenge. He responds immediately. He heads north. Now, along the way, he engages in a deliberate policy of destruction. He tells his troops, destroy all the crops, burn down the houses, destroy everything in your path. They kill every male they come across. They kill all the livestock they can get their hands on. It's basically like Sherman's march to the sea in Georgia during the American Civil War, but worse. And it gets an appropriate name. People refer to it as the harrying of the North. The king got to York, and he retook the city rather easily. And then he ordered his troops to fan out across the countryside of Yorkshire to carry out the same kind of destruction that they'd engaged in on the way north. And this destruction is so profound that its effects are still visible two decades later in Domesday Book. This is a great survey of English lands that we're going to be talking about in the next lecture. And you can see the results of the harrying of the north in that book. Well, there are still some rebels holding out near Chester in the northwest. So the king heads to Chester next. It's winter at this point, usually not a time when soldiers in the Middle Ages expect they're going to be fighting. You usually take the winter off. And William's soldiers are exhausted. They almost mutiny on the way to Chester. But the king somehow rallies them. He has amazing powers of leadership. And they get to Chester before the rebels are ready to meet them. And that's effectively it. That's the end of the English side of the revolt. The Danes are still on the loose, but they're discouraged at this point. And the king manages to pay them off. He pays the Danes a bribe, and the Danish fleet in the Humber ups anchor. So, essentially, you've got a Norman king paying Danegeld. Kind of ironic. William had just come through a relentless, tiring campaign, and it seemed a good trade-off to him. But remember what Kipling said about Danegeld. William was not rid of the Dane this time either. The next year, in 1070, King Svein comes back. This time, he's leading his fleet in person, and Edwin and Morcar join in also. The Danes meet up with an English rebel force. They're led by an English thane, an English nobleman in Lincolnshire named Hereward. Together, this rebel force attacks Peterborough Abbey in Northamptonshire, and sacks it. It's got a Norman abbot at this point, which maybe justifies the sack a little bit. But the monks of Peterborough, they remember this attack for many years to come with horror. Now, William responds by bribing Svein to go home again. And Svein does go home again. This leaves William free to go after Hereward. Hereward takes refuge in the Isle of Ely. Now, remember Ely from our discussion of Knut's reign. This is the church where Knut was charmed by the singing of the monks. Well, you'll also remember it's a marshy area. You're best off getting around by boat in that part of the country. It's a pretty good place to hole up and disappear. So William surrounds the rebels and he tries to starve them out. And there are wonderful stories about Hereward's adventures during the siege. Supposedly he disguised himself as a poor potter. He dressed in poor clothes and actually appropriated somebody's pots. And he made his way into King William's camp to gather intelligence. There are all sorts of stories like this. Later on, very similar stories are going to get attached to the Robin Hood legend, and we'll come to that later in the course. But despite all of Hereward's heroic efforts, most of the rebels surrender after a brief siege. Somehow, Hereward melts away, and nobody really knows what happened to him. Of the other rebels, we do know something. Edwin is betrayed by his own followers and killed. Morcar is captured and imprisoned, and he's in prison for the rest of William's reign. But the bottom line is that William once again defeats his enemies. He wins by using a combination of methods, and he always seems to know just the right mixture of elements. You need a little bit of ruthlessness, a little bit of bribery. You need to know who you pay off, who you crush. I think that's really the lesson of this great northern revolt. You have to conclude William will do whatever it takes to maintain control of England. And from this point on, the English mostly get the point. They're largely loyal to the king from this time on, including Edgar Atheling. He settles down quietly to life as a member of the comfortable classes. I think William quite rightly concludes that Edgar isn't much of a threat. In fact, Edgar later becomes very good friends with William's oldest son, Robert. The two go off on crusade together, and after a very long life of getting in and out of scrapes, I think largely because he's not very dangerous, people don't think he's much of a threat, Edgar Atheling dies in his bed in around 1125, in his mid-70s. The remaining revolts of William's reign are actually led by Normans, not by Englishmen. And the king is just as good at crushing those. And I'll talk about one of these Norman revolts in a moment. For now, though, let's think about what the Northern Revolt meant to William. It does seem to have caused him to rethink his methods of ruling England. He had been trying to rule through the existing structures, and to a large extent, that continues. The shire courts, the hundred courts, they keep meeting as usual. But he does start bringing in more of his own people. His writs start being issued in Latin rather than English. Clearly, he has gotten rid of the English clerks. He's brought in Norman ones. He also begins systematically replacing English bishops and abbots with Norman ones. He wants churchmen in place who he feels comfortable working with. But undoubtedly, the biggest changes take place with regard to the ownership of land. At first, William hadn't even really carried out any systematic confiscations of English land. He had taken away land from Englishmen who were actually in the field against him at Hastings, but people who had stayed out of the battle, they had kept their lands up till now. After the Great Northern Revolt, William gets a bit more hard-nosed. He starts confiscating lands of the English magnates and redistributing it to his Norman supporters. Now, there's a lot of controversy among historians about just how devastating a change this is, and I think it kind of depends on how you look at it, and particularly on where you are on the social scale. Obviously, for the English elite, it's a disaster. They're almost completely shut out of power, since land is the source of power. Virtually overnight, the old elite goes out, the new elite comes in. But these lands that were confiscated, they had people living on them, paying rent to their owners, owing labor services. And a lot of the time, those people just stayed exactly where they were. And instead of paying rent to a guy named Wolfgar, now they're paying it to a guy named Robert. It doesn't necessarily make a huge amount of difference to them. But the way in which the lands were distributed, that had long-term consequences for English history. King William gave out lands to his followers in a rather haphazard fashion. Often, he simply made them the heirs, the successors of various English nobles who had forfeited their lands. And these lands tended to be widely scattered. They don't form compact, contiguous lordships. That's much more the way it worked in Normandy, not in England. And the result is that the nobility in England doesn't have the same kind of secure territorial power bases that Norman lords do. And this has several implications for English history. First, it means English lords are not going to find it as easy to defy the king as Norman lords can. They couldn't rely on a big block of territory that they can hold against the king. This sort of thing is much more possible in Normandy, and this is one reason why Normandy is more of a problem than England is. The second result of this scattered distribution of lands is that nobles have a stake in things that are happening all over the country. They have kind of a national interest. And this is going to make a difference in the development of English politics and also in several major revolts in English history. And we'll get to that in future lectures. For now, let's get back to William the Conqueror and his plans for English lands. As I've said, most of the lands he confiscated were scattered estates, but there are several places where the king does create large territories for one particular magnate to rule. The two most important places he does this are at Chester in the northwest and Durham in the far north. And in both of these areas, it's for strategic reasons. He's worried about enemies on his borders. In Chester, it's the Welsh. In Durham, it's the Scots. And he makes the calculation that he'd rather risk having a lord with a pretty secure power base if he's going to be able to defend the country. So he sees it as better to have somebody on the spot because he can't possibly be on the borders all the time. Now, these compact lordships are going to have a long future in English history. They're called palatinates, and they're ruled over by an earl in Chester and a bishop in Durham. Now, there's one more important thing to say about what William does with land in England, and this touches on a big debate among historians. The debate is whether William introduces feudalism into England. Now, feudalism is one of those concepts that has so many problems with it that historians would really like to kill it, but it just won't die. In essence, feudalism is about fiefs. Fiefs are lands that somebody accepts from a lord in exchange for some kind of service, usually military service. The king gives you a piece of land. In exchange, you show up and fight in his army when he summons you to do so. Now, it's really the ism part of feudalism that historians don't like because they recognize that it was never a system. It's not systematic at all. Not all land was held in this way. Historians are divided over how important fiefs were before the conquest. But I think the important thing to stress is that William the Conqueror does increase the importance of fiefs in England. But while William is in the midst of this whole-scale redistribution of land, he has to face rebellion on several fronts from those very supporters that he's giving land to. Remember I said the English had learned their lesson? Well, the Normans had not. And in 1075, there's a major conspiracy. It's led by the Earl of Hereford and the Earl of East Anglia, both of whom are Normans. And the grievance is simply that the king isn't giving them enough favors, you know, not confirming them in their lands, their offices. And unlike the English revolts, this one is thus really entirely personal. The plot is actually hatched at a wedding feast. Now, the reason I mention this revolt, it doesn't amount to much militarily, is because it results in the last execution of an Englishman for treason in William's reign. Now, how is this? It's a Norman revolt. Among the wedding guests, where the plot is devised, is an English nobleman named Waltheof. And the reason he's there is that he has married the niece of William the Conqueror. And somehow, poor Waltheof gets swept up in the conspiracy. Now, when word of it gets out, Waltheof is actually the first to surrender. I don't think his heart was ever in the rebellion. But the king decides that he's going to treat the rebels separately according to their nationality. Normans will be dealt with by Norman law, English by English law. The penalty for treason under English law is beheading. So the Norman lords, they get off with the loss of their lands and liberty. Waltheof is executed. So justice in England is not yet entirely even-handed. Still, this episode shows that William had his problems with his Norman supporters just as much as he did with his English subjects, if not more so. So what's the solution? William tried, to a certain degree, to increase the authority of the crown with respect to the great lords, and he did this by articulating the principle that he's at the top of a hierarchy of landholding, everyone else comes underneath him. In effect, William is making it clear that all the land in England is held of the king. The next layer of landholders under the king are the so-called tenants-in-chief. Tenants-in-chief are people who hold their lands directly of the king. He is their immediate lord. They're accountable directly to him for their military service. Now, under the tenants-in-chief are people called subtenants. These are people who owe service to the tenants-in-chief, who owe service to the king. So there's essentially a pyramid with the king at the top. This is a simplification, but broadly it holds. But William injects a new kind of discipline into this feudal structure, and the clearest expression of this came in August of 1086, towards the end of William's reign, with the so-called Salisbury Oath. This is an occasion when William gathers all the great landowners of the country at Salisbury, and he demands a personal oath of loyalty, and he wants you to swear the oath whether or not you're a tenant-in-chief, that is, whether or not you hold your land directly of the king or whether there's another lord in between you and the king. William is making it clear that he's the king of all the landowners, not just of the men who are his own vassals directly. And this had very important ramifications. In the normal feudal way of things, your loyalty is to your lord, full stop. If your lord rebels against his lord, you rebel with him. But William, at Salisbury, is articulating the claim that everybody needs to be loyal to the king, not to their own lord one step higher up in the feudal chain. William is trying to short-circuit the normal channels of rebellion that are so much of a problem in Normandy. And in fact, it does prove far less common in England for the lords at the bottom to follow their lords into revolt against the king. Part of the reason is these scattered lordships all over the country. But part of it is also that the English kings are asking for the loyalty of all their subjects. What we're seeing is the creation of a very strong kingship. In contrast to what's going on in France at the time, there the king is just having to fight to survive against his nobles, the English kings start from a presumption of strength. Now, of course, they're building on a strong foundation laid by the Anglo-Saxon monarchy, but a lot of the credit goes to the personality of William the Conqueror. When William dies in 1087, he is actually in Normandy. Nevertheless, the English accept his son, William II, as king without a whisper of opposition. That's quite an achievement for a foreign conqueror with, let's admit it, a dubious claim to the throne. In our next lecture, we'll look at the implications of the Norman conquest for the mass of English people on the ground as they try to come to grips with conquest and create a new people out of the English and the Normans.
Lecture 13, Conflict and Assimilation.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we looked at the reign of William the Conqueror, and we concentrated mostly on what William had to do to consolidate his conquest of England. He had to cope with rebellions, certainly, and one of the ways he did this was to make a whole-scale redistribution of lands to his supporters. He essentially created a new elite in England. But he left most of the lower layers of the social hierarchy largely as they were. For many English people, the most important immediate result of the Norman conquest is that they get a new lord. But that was just the start of the process of creating a new society, a blend of English and Norman. And in this lecture, I want to talk in a little bit of detail about what this process is like. How do English and Normans deal with one another? So we'll look at the legal implications of the conquest, but we're also going to look at the social and cultural effects of the conquest. How do people interact with each other? How are they affected on a personal level by the change of regime? In this lecture, we're going to use a variety of very different kinds of sources to answer these questions. The first one we'll look at is the famous Domesday Book, and we're going to spend quite a bit of time on Domesday Book. This is an amazing work. It includes all sorts of information about land and people in England under William the Conqueror. It'll tell us a lot of hard facts. It'll tell us how many plows there are on the estates of the Bishop of Lincoln in Huntingdonshire. But we're also going to look at chronicles and other sources to get a feel of what post-conquest England is like. So that's the plan for this lecture. Let's start with Domesday Book. It's really two books, one very large book and one smaller book, but they go together. And they contain information about English lands. It's organized county by county. And then within each county chapter, there are entries for the lands of each major landholder in that county. That's the basic setup of Domesday Book. Now, it's an extremely complicated document, and it's very controversial. Many books have been written about it, and scholars disagree about almost everything to do with it, including the very basic question of what it's supposed to be for. We can't be completely sure what the point of Domesday Book is. Why was it made? Some scholars think the king is trying to pave the way for imposing a new kind of tax, so he wants to know how do you assess the tax throughout England. Some people think he's trying to square away who has the right to different estates. We'll deal with this question a little bit later in the lecture. But first, I want to describe what Domesday is and how it was compiled, and then we'll try to figure out why it was compiled and what it was used for. The first thing to say is Domesday Book is an amazing resource. If William the Conqueror did anything that modern historians bless him for, it was ordering the compilation of Domesday Book in 1086. Now, of course, William doesn't call it Domesday Book. That's a nickname given to it a bit later, because people come to feel that the information in Domesday Book is destined to last until the end of time. Hence, Domesday. But William isn't thinking about the end of time. He's thinking about right now. He needs information, for some reason, we are not exactly sure why, and he sets up a very elaborate process to get that information. Here's what a later chronicler says about what William wants to know. He wants to find out how many hides of land there are in England. Remember, a hide is a unit of land notionally meant to support a single family. He wants to know how many hides of land the king has and how many hides the various barons and bishops have. And here it's important to remember the church owns a lot of land. The king also wants to know, what are these lands worth? How much revenue can they bring in? And also, this is quite interesting, he wants to know what these lands used to produce in the time of King Edward the Confessor. And this is a way of getting at how the economy has changed after the Norman conquest. Essentially, the king wants to know everything he can about the productive capacity of England. How rich are we? What do we really have? Now, this level of detail made a very big impression on people at the time. Nothing like this had ever been attempted before. And in a later chronicler's description of this, you can hear a sort of sense of amazement about the Domesday Project. He wrote, "So thoroughly was all this carried out that there did not remain in the whole of England a single hide of land, or an ox, or a cow, or a pig that was not written in that brief." You can almost get a sense that this chronicler is a little bit oppressed by this. He's sort of feeling as if this is Big Brother going a bit too far. But you can't help but be impressed by how William went about getting all of this information. He mobilized literally hundreds, probably thousands of people who all worked to create the final product. The first step is to create commissions. These are small groups of officials who are assigned to a particular part of England. That's their territory that they're going to cover. And these areas are called circuits. And each one was made up of a group of counties. There were seven of these circuits, and they're organized to make sense geographically. For example, Circuit 2 is made up of five counties in the southwest: Wiltshire, Somerset, Dorset, Devon, and Cornwall. This is a pretty coherent territory. Circuit 7 is made up of three counties in the east: Norfolk, Suffolk, and Essex. The idea clearly is that these are parts of the country that form a unit, and that makes sense. Okay, you're a doomsday commissioner. You've just been told you're doing Circuit 7. Actually, they wouldn't have been told that exactly. These numbers have been assigned to the circuits by modern scholars. So you've been told your job is Norfolk, Suffolk, and Essex. Go find out everything you can. What do you do next? Well, you go off with the firm intention of taking full advantage of all of those elaborate administrative structures that were set up by the Anglo-Saxon state, the counties, the hundreds, all of that that we covered in a previous lecture. So the commissioners go to each county by turn, and in each county, they convene juries of local men from each hundred, each subdivision of the county. And they ask the jurors a series of questions about the land in that hundred. And the idea is that people in each local area are going to know who owns what land and what it's worth. There's probably some sort of basic questionnaire that the commissioners are working from. It varies a bit from circuit to circuit. In some places, they clearly ask more questions about livestock than they did in others. But essentially, they're after the same information, the basics I mentioned before. Who owns what land? Where is it? How much is it worth? One of the most interesting things that the juries were asked is, how much was the land worth in the past, and how much is it worth now? And they expressed this based on the king who was ruling at the time. So the value of the land in 1066 is called the value in the time of King Edward. The value in 1086, at the time the survey was done, that's in the time of King William. So you have a record of how values have changed during this very eventful 20-year period. I mentioned in the last lecture that you could actually trace the effects of the harrying of the North, the results of the Northern Rebellion. Doomsday Book is where you can do that. There are places where the value in the time of King Edward is much higher than the value in the time of King William, because those areas have not yet recovered from all of the looting and burning that was done at that point in the reign. On the other hand, there are plenty of areas where the values went up. So there's not a consistent pattern across England of how land values change. The economy is fairly localized. Lots of factors go into determining if an area is going to grow or not. But one big thing that helps is not having an army troop through your lands. So the juries provide quite a lot of information. Probably they did have some written records to go on. These are records kept at the hundred level and the county level. These records don't survive, but we can tell from Doomsday Book that there have to been some written sources to provide this level of detail. But there were some questions that couldn't be answered just by looking them up in a document. The juries were also asked to pronounce on some controversial questions, like who really had title to a particular piece of land in the neighborhood. There might have been a dispute about that. Perhaps it stretched back many years. One of the interesting things in Doomsday Book are the places where the jurors claim ignorance. They simply say, we don't know who has the right to that particular estate. Now, one modern scholar, I think, has made a very convincing argument about what's happening here. The jurors don't want to go on record one way or the other because they're caught between a rock and a hard place. They have to live in this neighborhood after the Doomsday Commissioners leave. And they're going to be rubbing shoulders with the two people who are having the dispute. So it's safest to just say, we don't know. So I think this gives us a sense of the wonderful complexity of post-conquest England. On the one hand, you've got this very sophisticated administrative machinery. You can actually go out and mobilize these juries all over the country to provide this detailed information. But on the other hand, sometimes these people are scared to death of their neighbors. So this is both assimilation and conflict at work. So the juries have now testified. Now, you, the commissioners, gather up the information. It's on lots of separate sheets of parchment called briefs. And these briefs are gathered up, they're brought back to a central location, and ultimately they're used to create Doomsday Book. and we can tell that the scribes of Doomsday Book abbreviated the information in the briefs. There was originally even more detail than we have now. We know this because there are other documents made from the briefs that do have more detail. Clearly, the Doomsday Book scribes figure that if they put in everything, nobody's going to be able to lift the final product. So the work of the commissioners is done. We know what Doomsday Book is. We know how it was compiled. But why was it compiled? That's a question. I'm not going to go into too much detail. As I've said, historians have gotten very exercised about this. I'm just going to give you the main theories, and then we're going to leave the question open. Some historians think that the king wanted to gather all of this information because he wants to impose a new kind of tax in England. He's going to use a new unit called the plowland. That's the theory. But the information in Doomsday Book is not organized in the best way for collecting taxes. It's listed within each county by landowner. This means if you want to hit up individual landowners who own land in more than one county, which is very commonly the case, you have to look at the information in more than one county. It's very cumbersome. But the biggest problem with this argument is also the fact that the method of collecting taxes wasn't changed. So it's a lot of trouble to go to and then change your mind about wanting to do it. One of the most interesting theories ties Doomsday Book to the famous event that took place in August of 1086 at Salisbury. This is the occasion I mentioned in the last lecture when King William gathers all the leading men of the kingdom and has them swear an oath of loyalty directly to him. One historian has argued that the king extracted the oath in exchange for Doomsday Book, because Doomsday Book was a register of who really had the right to the land. And this was something that was going to help people feel secure in their title to land. It's a quid pro quo. You promise to serve me loyally, I'll ratify title to your land. Other historians have pointed out, though, that by this point, 20 years into the reign, most people are pretty secure about how their title is. After 20 years, some of the people who swear the oath at Salisbury are actually the sons of the first people to get the land. It's already been inherited once. So people aren't really that worried. We aren't going to solve this. So I want to move on to say something very briefly about some ways Doomsday Book was in fact used, whether that's why it was compiled in the first place or not. At the end of some of the county records in Doomsday Book, there's a section called clamores. Now, the Latin word clamores is what we get our word clamor from, big noise, and it means complaints. These are records of some of the three tricky disputes that I mentioned, where the jury sometimes don't want to get involved. And a remarkable number of these disputes actually do get addressed in the royal courts in the decades after Doomsday Book. And the last of these complaints is settled well into the 12th century. And on a more general level, for centuries afterwards, people who find themselves in a dispute about the right to a particular piece of property would actually go to the Exchequer, the English Treasury Department, and we'll talk about that in the next lecture, where Doomsday Book was kept, and they would copy out the information from Doomsday Book that pertained to the particular estate they were interested in. So whether it's intended to be a register of title deeds in the first place, that is what it became. Now, I mentioned earlier that historians love Doomsday Book, even though they can't agree on what it was supposed to be. Doomsday has now been digitized, so we can learn a tremendous amount about the English economy at the time of the survey simply from crunching the Doomsday numbers. That's how we know about the various economic trends after the conquest, how some areas were doing well and others weren't. We can also use this data to learn some other things about life in post-conquest England. So I want to turn from Doomsday Book itself now to talk for a few minutes about the society that Doomsday Book reveals to us. One thing that Doomsday Book seems to show us is that this is a society where the social structure varies a lot from region to region. One of the most interesting aspects of this variation is that the degree of freedom you see in different parts of the country varies. There are still a large number of slaves recorded in Doomsday Book. Now, slaves were going to decrease in number as we head into the 12th century. But still in 1086, there are large numbers of slaves. There are also many serfs. These are people who are not technically slaves. They're not owned outright, but they're tied to particular estates. Historians aren't really sure exactly when this category of people appears, these people who are sort of intermediate between slave and free. They're probably a product of the increasing power of kings and lords in the late Anglo-Saxon period. But at any rate, you see lots of them in Domesday Book, and their numbers are going to go up, just as the number of slaves will go down. But in some areas, especially in eastern England, in East Anglia, there seem to have been a large number of free men, people who either owned their land outright or who owed really very minimal obligations for their land. These are people who have the right to participate in the public courts, and they have a special name. They're called sokemen. So there are plenty of people who aren't dependent on a lord. So the personal status of English people can vary quite a bit. Now, despite these legal variations, it's important to stress that the overwhelming majority of English men and women are still dependent directly on the produce of the soil. Now, this much has not changed very much at all since we last looked at English society in the Anglo-Saxon period. There are probably several million people living in England in 1086. This is a very rough estimate. Most of them are working small plots of land according to the very basic geographical divisions we've talked about before, mostly arable farming in the southeast, mostly pastoral in the northwest. And most farmers are working on estates owned by lords. Now, these estates are called manors, and manors are the smallest units of agricultural production. A manor might include an entire village. However, some manors are big enough to include more than one village, and some villages belong partly to one manor and partly to another. Okay? That was obviously confusing, but it did happen. So manors and villages are not always exactly the same, but the manor is the basic unit of agricultural production. Farm labor, of course, is extremely arduous, but at least there have been some improvements since the Anglo-Saxon period. Gradually, a three-field system of crop rotation is being introduced. This increases the amount of land under cultivation at any one time. You can have only one-third of the land lying fallow while two-thirds are being used. You plant a series of crops, often wheat and then rye, but you might also plant legumes. That helps with the nitrogen level of the soil. Also, the horse collar has been introduced, and that gives horses greater traction in pulling a plow. The day of the horse is just dawning. Still in 1086, most farmers are using teams of oxen, but we will see the horse take over down the road. The thing about oxen is that they represent a huge capital investment. A single peasant family usually can't afford a whole team of 6 to 8 oxen. So the teams of oxen would be shared by the families in the village, and this meant that the village had to cooperate in dividing up access to the oxen team. And since oxen are very hard to turn, it's hard to turn the team of oxen around, what they would do is arrange their land in very narrow strips so that you could go a long way with your oxen before you had to turn them. And this gives English villages a very characteristic pattern. Usually you have a nucleus. In the center, you've got the dwellings. And then radiating out from the houses, you've got these long, long strips of land. And each family would own several of these strips, but they wouldn't be next to each other. This would reflect the fact that there was an arrangement about who got the plow. One family would get it one day, then the next team would get it the next day, and it would go sort of all the way around the radius of the settlement. Now, obviously, there would be arguments about this. Whose strip is whose? Who gets the oxen on Thursday? And for this reason, manors would have their own courts that would handle disputes like these. And we'll talk more about these manor courts in a future lecture. Now, manors do seem to have increased in number after the conquest. You have more peasants. I think we can call them that at this point. We have more peasants under the control of lords than before the conquest. But the most dramatic change in the landscape that's due to the conquest is undoubtedly the creation of the forest law. I mentioned in the very first lecture that control of the forests in England is a very valuable thing because they have all sorts of resources. They have timber, of course, but sources of food. The Norman kings, starting with William the Conqueror, create a brand new institution called the Royal Forest. And what this means is certain areas in England are declared to be officially the Royal Forest, and special laws will apply there. Hunting of game is restricted. Only the king can hunt for deer in the Royal Forest. Hunting is the quintessential royal pursuit, and the kings want to make sure that there are always going to be enough deer to be hunted. You also can't trap animals or cut down timber. It's an area of restricted access. And the laws to punish violators are very severe, often much more severe than penalties in the normal courts. Now, given how important wild sources of food are to making a living in this period, these restrictions could be a real hardship to the local community. And sometimes, to make matters worse, the king would declare an area to be part of the forest even if it doesn't really have a lot of trees. And this was just to increase the amount of money that he could collect in fines for the various offenses. So people really hate the forest law. But the forests do at least provide jobs. And we have records, starting in the 12th century, of men whose job it is to hunt wolves in the royal forests, because you don't want the wolves getting the deer either. So life for peasants, the people at the bottom of the social ladder, maybe doesn't change all that much due to the conquest, except in the newly afforested areas. There's a different lord, but they could live with that. There's a bit of improvement for slaves, a bit of a reduction in status for free peasants. The class of people at the bottom, it's becoming slightly more uniform from a legal point of view. But there are changes higher up the ladder that directly contribute to creating a new kind of English people, one made up of men and women of both English ancestry and Norman ancestry, all of whom think of themselves as English. And this is probably already true by the late 12th century. Now, within a single generation, English and Normans are making accommodations with each other. They're beginning to get along. One way this happens is due to intermarriage, and this happens right away. At the top of the scale, William the Conqueror is encouraging marriages between his followers and English heiresses. That's a very easy way to transfer land from English hands to Norman hands. One important result of these marriages is the children often grow up bilingual. They speak both French and English. And the process goes on as the result of unions that are a little bit less authorized as well. For example, the famous Norman administrator and cleric, Ranulf Flambard, who later becomes Bishop of Durham, he had an English mistress named Alviva in the town of Huntingdon, and he later married her off to an accommodating Norman follower. Many clerics from Normandy married English wives. Now, they're not supposed to be marrying anybody, but the church is only just starting to crack down on marriage by priests at this point. So the process of assimilation is beginning, to a large degree, behind closed doors. Of course, language is one very important thing that changes as a result of the conquest, because French now becomes the prestige language. Upwardly mobile Englishmen do what they can to learn French, because they know this is going to give them a leg up on the social ladder, and they certainly know that they're going to be at a disadvantage without it. And this was true for both laymen and clerics. And there's a wonderful story from the life of St. Wolfrich of Hazelbury. He lived from about 1080 to 1154, so really in this post-conquest generation. He cured a man who was dumb. Okay? And after the cure, the man was able to speak both French and English. He hadn't known any French before, but now after the cure, he can speak French. And this really upsets the local priest. The local priest says to Wolfrich, "Can't you give me French as well? I'm forced to keep my mouth shut when the bishop comes because I don't know any French." Now, one really interesting aspect of the conquest, something quite different from a lot of more modern conquests, is the English don't seem to have had any problem with French. They don't resist it. Those who can, learn it. Now, fewer Normans learn English, but again, this is a factor of social class. The higher up you are, the less you have to bother learning English. If you're the king's forester, you probably do need to speak English to do your job. The English also begin giving their children Norman names. This is a way of social climbing also, and it holds more the higher up you go on the social scale. So the overall number of English-sounding names like Wolfrich, that gradually goes down, and you see the rise of a lot of Williams and Roberts and Henrys. The English names don't disappear, but within a generation or two of the conquest, you can no longer tell just by looking at somebody's name whether their ethnicity is Norman or English. Now, for historians, this is really annoying, because it's harder than to figure out who people are and where they come from. But I think it's a sign that assimilation is proceeding on its merry way. Now, one very useful thing for historians, though, is that the Norman conquest seems to have stimulated a passion for English history, and it cut across ethnic lines. There's a market for works of English history, so a lot of them were written. And so we have great chronicles for the early Norman period in England. It seems as if the new residents of England want to get to know their adopted homeland. And a lot of the historians who take up this task, they come from ethnically mixed backgrounds. And this is the case most famously for the great historian Orderic Vitalis. He was born in England, in Shropshire. His father was a Norman cleric, and his mother was English. He learned Latin from an English priest. And then he's sent at the age of 10 or 11 to a Norman monastery called Saint-Evroul to become a monk. And he talks very movingly about what a wrench this was to leave his father, and he never saw his father again. Now, here he is in Normandy. From this vantage point, he writes a history of England, and it's one of our most useful sources for this period, and it's very pro-English. There are other writers like this who are probably of mixed ancestry, people like William of Malmesbury. They also wrote histories of England. Now, these writers wrote in Latin. But one of the most fascinating texts of this period is a history of England written in French. It's written by a man named Geoffrey Guymar, and it was commissioned by a noble patroness, a woman of Norman background named Constance FitzGilbert. She was the wife of a powerful baron. And essentially, Guymar's text is a translation of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle from English into French. So one of the things that helped assimilation along in England is clearly the fact that the Normans who settle in England embrace the English past. They start to feel part of it. They have to read about it in French, but it was still, in a certain sense, their English history. Now, this is not to say that there were never any ethnic tensions. There certainly were. For quite a while after the conquest, there are certain jobs at the top of the hierarchy in both church and state that Englishmen can't get. There are hardly any English-born bishops for more than a generation, and the king's top advisors are certainly all of Norman background. This was noticed and resented and commented upon. And there are signs that the Normans looked down on the English, at least for a generation or two. And the most telling example of this, I think, comes from the reign of Henry I, who ruled from 1100 to 1135. And we're going to talk a lot about him in the next lecture. Henry was reputed to be an Anglophile. At least he had relationships with a lot of English women. But it seems to have gone deeper than that. And he married a woman who was descended from the old English royal line, the Princess Matilda of Scotland, who was the great-great-granddaughter of Æthelred and the great-granddaughter of Edmund Ironside. And King Henry did this because he wanted to reconcile the two royal lines, English and Norman, and this does seem to have helped, at least with his English subjects, quite a bit. Henry even asked that his son William be known as William Atheling. That's the English term for a royal prince, a potential successor to the throne. So Henry's doing a lot to meet his English subjects more than halfway. But some of his Norman subjects mocked him for this. They like to refer to King Henry and his very English wife as Godric and Godgifu. Now, Godric and Godgifu are two very quintessentially English names, and the idea is clearly the king and his wife are much too English for some of the Normans to put up with. Ultimately, though, the English and the Normans make their peace with each other surprisingly quickly. There is, of course, a little name-calling along the way. Well, by this point, we have an England that comes through the conquest, I think with much less ethnic conflict than we might have supposed. It's recovering nicely from the damage caused by the conquest, And the English and the Normans are reaching out to one another. They're creating a new English identity. It's strongly rooted in the English past. In our next lecture, we'll look in detail at the reign of the king who is a perfect model for this assimilation, Henry I, the king who is mockingly referred to as Godric. We'll see what sort of a king the youngest of William the Conqueror's sons turned out to be.
Lecture 14, Henry I, the Lion of Justice.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we looked at England after the Norman conquest, and we talked about how the English and the Normans are beginning to assimilate to each other. They're creating a new English people who share a basic pride in the history of England, and they can all identify with that, whether or not their ancestors originally came from Normandy or from England. This process took many years, of course, and we noted that still in the early 12th century, there are some tensions between the two groups. There are Englishmen who resent being shut out of the top jobs, and there are Normans who still look down on the English. And this even led some people to mock King Henry I for being too English. Now, today we're going to get to know Henry I, because besides having this pro-English outlook that he got teased for, he's one of the most important kings in English history. He consolidated the gains that William the Conqueror had made, and he presided over some very important advances in the government of England over the course of his very long reign. He ruled from 1100 to 1135. So we'll spend almost all of this lecture on Henry's career as king. But before we put Henry on the throne, we need to back up a bit to the end of the reign of his father, William the Conqueror. William died in 1087, the year after the famous Salisbury Oath, the year after Doomsday Book. And William the Conqueror left behind three grown sons, Robert, William, and Henry. Now, William did not leave everything to the eldest son, Robert. Instead, he divided up his resources among the three brothers, and this caused problems among the brothers, and they wouldn't be resolved until there was only one of them left alive. So who are these three sons of William the Conqueror? The oldest one, Robert, seems to have been the favorite son of his mother, the Duchess Matilda. Normally, Matilda worked very closely, very harmoniously with her husband, but the only times we know of when she disagreed with him and even defied him are the times when she helped her son Robert stand up to his father. Unfortunately, Robert was on his father's bad side a lot. He repeatedly rebelled against William, and it's the perpetual problem of a royal prince with not enough to do. They tended to get into trouble that way. And Robert inspired various reactions among his contemporaries. He had many good friends, and by all accounts, he was an excellent companion. He was fun to be with. But he did have one of those unfortunate nicknames that we've run into before. He was called Robert Curthose, or Short Trousers. One historian has turned this into colloquial English as Little Bobby Short Pants. And that, obviously, does not inspire tremendous confidence. Now, William's second son, another William, is also got a nickname. He's called William Rufus because of his ruddy complexion. And finally, there's the youngest son, Henry. At the time of William the Conqueror's death, he thus has three grown sons. He's King of England, and he's also, of course, still Duke of Normandy. How is he going to divide up his dominions? Well, he has a little time to think about this. He has a few days' notice that he's going to die. William is in Normandy. He's taken care of a little border skirmish with the French. And there are conflicting accounts of what happened. Here's one version. William was just in the act of sacking the town of Mantes. There are houses burning all around him. And one of the burning embers from a house that was on fire frightened his horse and caused it to bolt. Now, by this point, William the Conqueror is a little on the heavy side, and he's thrown at an awkward angle against the pommel of his saddle. and this causes a lethal rupture. Other sources just say he came down with a fatal intestinal complaint. But at any rate, he knew he was on his deathbed, and his magnates gathered around him to find out what's going to happen after he dies. Now, William is determined that he's not going to leave anything to his feckless oldest son, Robert. But his barons prevail on him to at least let Robert have Normandy. They've all gotten used to Robert being the designated heir. And I think they probably also thought that they were going to have a much freer hand with Robert as Duke than they had with William.